This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Welcome to another in NHPR's 2016 Conversations with the Candidate series. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our series continues today with 2nd District Republican candidate Jim Lawrence. We've also invited the Democratic candidate, Congresswoman Ann McClain Custer, to join us at a future date. This hour, Josh and I will ask Mr. Lawrence about some of the top issues in this race. We'll also present questions from our listeners received in advance on social media. And we'll hear from our audience here at NHPR, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. We're also streaming on Facebook Live, so welcome everyone, and welcome Jim Lawrence.
Thanks for having me this morning, Laura and Josh. This is an extreme pleasure to be here today.
Well, we've got lots of time to go through lots of questions, and I'll start off, Mr. Lawrence, by asking you about something that your presidential nominee, Donald Trump, has said repeatedly, that this presidential election is rigged. Do you agree?
You know, unfortunately, I've had the opportunity to answer a lot of questions about what the presidential candidates have said this go-around, and I'm going to answer this one very similar to what I've said in the past. I think, unfortunately, a lot of times the media will ask candidates who are running for other offices what the presidential candidates are doing and what they're saying, and I think, unfortunately, that it has the unintended consequence of distracting the voters from what I think are the real important issues that they face, the things that they need to get information about in order to make an informed decision when they come to the voting booth in November. So what my answer is I think Donald Trump needs to own the statements that he makes. He's accountable for what he says. I'm not going to agree with everything that he says, but my main focus will be now and forever will have to be the voters of the 2nd Congressional District of New Hampshire and what I believe to be the important issues to them in this election cycle. And for me, that's getting our economy moving, looking at the national debt, the $19.5 trillion national debt, making sure that we have good foreign policy and a strong national defense to keep us safe, dealing with our Social Security crisis that's looming. These are the issues that I'd like to talk about and focus on for my race.
Well, and you preview many of the issues that we're definitely going to talk about you this hour, Mr. Lawrence. But I do wonder, how confident are you in the elections and voting process? Mr. Trump seems to have concerns. I wonder if you share them.
Well, you know, in my background, I served 3 terms here in the New Hampshire State House. I had the pleasure of serving my constituency there. And I've had a lot of experience of dealing with our Secretary of State, Bill Gardner. And I feel very fortunate because I don't think that New Hampshire or New Hampshire citizens have a high degree of fear that our elections are not handled properly.
Here in the state.
In this state, we're very fortunate that in this state that we've got it right more times than not. And I have confidence that in this election cycle, particularly for my race, that we'll get it right once again and we'll have a very professional election cycle run by a very competent Secretary of State here in New Hampshire.
Do you feel, Mr. Lawrence, that these statements are, as some have said, dangerous for our democracy, possibly inciting violence if the outcome doesn't come the way that Mr. Trump wants?
Well, I think American politics is a full contact sport, but I don't see violence coming out of our election cycle. No, we're Americans. We've been able to demonstrate to the world for, you know, many, many decades that we can have contentious, hard-fought political fights based on the issues. And after the election, we all come together as Americans.
Josh Rogers, next question to you.
Good morning and welcome. You know, as you mentioned, you've served in the legislature for 3 terms, and this is now your 2nd congressional run. But I think it's fair to say that many grandstanders are just getting to know you. As far as your professional background goes, you've founded a company that, according to your campaign, advised the Department of Defense on efficiency and on weapon systems. Can you give us a specific example of a contract your company won or work on a specific weapon system?
Well, I can give you several. We've worked on some very relevant weapon systems to the Department of Defense, particularly the Department of the Air Force. We worked on such programs such as the AWACS program, Joint STARS. We've also touched some of the space systems as well, for example, the GPS program. And to give you a specific example, one of the things that we did very early on in our company was to actually go in and look at the total cost of ownership of a weapon system. Because a lot of people don't realize it costs a lot of money in certain cases to actually buy something like an AWACS. But it costs a lot more to sustain it and keep it in the field. So you actually have the opportunity to gain considerable savings by looking at what some of those long-term decisions you're making in terms of how long you're going to keep a system in the field, how you can efficiently field it and maintain it.
And as far as your time in Concord, three terms representing your community of Hudson, three terms is not an eternity by the standards of the New Hampshire House, as you know, but it's a decent period of time. Were there any specific pieces of legislation that you were a part of that you're particularly proud of that would give voters a sense of what you'd pursue if they elected you to serve in Congress?
Well, you know, I was proud of everything that I did when I was in the State House, everything that I worked on. And I can honestly tell you that when I first went to Concord, I went there like most people do, as a young, energetic legislator who thought that I could, you know, really affect change very rapidly. Lo and behold, I realized that there were 424 other people that were part of that decision-making process, and I had to bring them along for the ride. So my first – and I'm going to talk about, you know, some of my struggles my first term, actually, before I begin to answer that question. Every single piece of legislation that I introduced as a freshman legislator, which I thought were wonderful ideas, and they crossed the spectrum. Me being an Air Force veteran, I focused a lot on veterans issues, particularly in that first term, and none of my legislation passed. But I guess what I learned from that process is, though, even though I was a freshman legislator, even though I didn't accomplish my mission that first term, I'm proud to say whether my name is on the bill or not, every single piece of veterans legislation that I introduced that first term is now law. So by the time I left the State House, either through working through other legislators or working myself, I was able to accomplish all of those goals that I had set to make sure that veterans were treated on parity, whether they served in Desert Storm or during the Vietnam era. So I'm very proud of that that legacy there as well. So I guess the reason why I'm getting to that is that we talk about Washington, D.C. We talk about gridlock in Washington and the inability of the Congress to actually move agendas forward. I think those experiences that I take from Concord will suit me well to be able to go down to Washington, D.C., be realistic about what I could potentially accomplish, and understand how I could actually build coalitions to actually get that job done.
A couple of quick follow-ups to Josh's biographical questions, Mr. Lawrence. First of all, in terms of defense system, just remind us, what's an AWAC?
The AWACS is it's basically a large body aircraft. It's the Boeing 707 that has what's called a radome aerial radar on top of it. It was originally developed during the Cold War to help keep us safe from the potential incursion of nuclear bombers coming from Russia. In the modern day, we use it to give us real-time battlefield situational awareness on what air assets that are enemy aircraft that are in the area. It's like having your own air traffic control tower up in the air in any war zone deployed anywhere in the world.
So it was your job to advise the Defense Department on how much it kept, how much it cost to keep this thing up and running? Is that it?
Well, you know, this is a very large, complex system. There's a whole lot of pieces that are moving in there. I was just citing a specific program that we were working on. We were actually embedded with the Department of Defense and advising them specifically on some of the decisions they were making for the sustainment tail. In other words, how they were going to actually maintain this fleet of, at the time, 33 aircraft we had worldwide.
And you mentioned just a moment ago your time as an Air Force veteran. What was your specialty when you were in the Air Force, and did you serve in any of the wars that we've seen over the past 20 years?
Okay, when I graduated from the United States Air Force Academy, I was actually looking forward to going to undergraduate pilot training. Unfortunately, at that time, we were at a point where we were at a force drawdown. So we cut fighter wings.
When was that?
1993. So I was actually in a category that they would call it a delayed status. In other words, if the need came up for additional pilots, they would call me back up. Fortunately for me, actually, I didn't think it was so fortunate at the time, the Air Force decided to use me more for the wonderful training and education that I was able to benefit from the United States Air Force Academy. And they embedded me in the Space and Missile Systems Center at the time to help them with some of their larger acquisition programs.
Kind of setting the groundwork for the work that you're doing today, but it sounds like you kind of wanted to see some action.
Look, let's put it this way. I was honored to be a member of the United States Air Force. I would have served in any capacity that my leadership saw fit for me to do.
Okay, let's go to a question from our audience here at NHPR, including members from the Concord Young Professionals Network. And we've got someone at the microphone. Good morning. Thanks for being here. And please give us your first name and ask your question.
Good morning. My name is Angie. I'm from Holderness. Mr. Lawrence, how do you intend to balance representing both the people of Nashua and Concord and those of us from the rural North Country?
Angie, thank you for the question.
Yes, Angie, thank you for that question. One of the things that a lot of people don't necessarily know right off the bat is that the 2nd Congressional District is huge. It's probably one of the only congressional districts I can imagine in the country could say something along the lines, oh, my district borders on Maine, the Canadian border, Vermont, and Massachusetts. And with that comes a lot of diversity in terms of the type of terrain that you're covering, the type of communities that you have to represent. And you're absolutely correct. I mean, there's a big difference between the people or the challenges that people face in Holderness versus Salem versus Nashua versus Claremont versus Keene. I'm very proud to say that now, having done this campaign cycle over 2 congressional races, I've had the benefit of being able to cover all of this terrain several times. And what I could tell you is that even though there are some differences in those communities and what challenges they face, there are some real needs that are common. I think people in Holderness and people in Nashua both understand the importance of improving our economy. They both understand the challenges that we face as a nation with grappling with our $19.5 trillion in debt. They also understand the common threats that we face from our failed foreign policy with the emergence of ISIS, dangers posed to us by terrorist attacks. These are all common things. And that's probably the easiest thing for me to say, that I can address those issues and do a good job of representing all communities in the district. However, I will say this. I do understand that there are also some nuances in terms of what the North Country, the southern tier of the state, even the Connecticut River Valley will face. So the only thing I could tell you at this time is that I've campaigned that way as I was running for Congress. I made sure that I ran a full district campaign and listened to the communities that I look to serve. I could tell you, as your congressman, I will have dedicated constituent services in each region of the state, and I will be focused squarely on the needs of every single diverse population that exists within the 2nd CD of New Hampshire.
Angie, thank you again for the question. And just a follow-up to that North-South issue that Angie raises, as you know, Mr. Lawrence, in the North Country, there's a lot of opposition to the Northern Pass hydropower project. In the southern part of your district, it's a little more mixed. Some people don't want it. Some businesses say, yes, we want this for the jobs, for the hopefully cheaper electricity. What would be your role as a member of Congress on this Northern Pass debate, which, as you know, is dividing your district?
Yeah, it is dividing our district. And unfortunately, there's only so much that Congress can actually do to weigh in this particular project. But I have taken a position on this. I took it 2 years ago. And what I said then, I still believe is the case now. Northern Pass, the project as it's laid out right now, is not a good deal for the citizens of New Hampshire. Unfortunately, it's asking us to give up far, far too much and getting little or nothing in terms of guarantees in return. As we know, the North Country relies very heavily on the pristine and the beautiful landscape that they have for their tourism industry, which Northern Pass threatens. There are also some serious concerns, in my estimation, as to the plan as it's laid out right now, because there's no guarantee that New Hampshire ratepayers will get any of the relief that the project currently promises.
Is this something that you would outright oppose or put a lot of conditions on? Again, recognizing that it's not entirely up to members of Congress.
Yeah,
it's
Congress only has a limited role in this. Right now, as I look at the plan, I'm opposed to it because it doesn't do those things that I think it does, that it's going to need to do to ensure New Hampshire citizens that it's going to be a good deal for them. Hey, look, if they want to plow through our state and run these lines through New Hampshire to get electricity into the grid, it's incumbent upon us as New Hampshire citizens to stand up for our benefits and make sure that there are provisions that are going to benefit the state of New Hampshire. And right now, this project doesn't do it.
Well, speaking of hydropower and other types of alternative energy, here's a question from our audience that we got on social media in advance of today's program. By the way, if you want to send us an email, you can send us one at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page for Jim Lawrence. Again, he's the 2nd District Republican nominee for Congress. Here's the question from a listener, Mr. Lawrence. Where do you stand on the federal clean power plan, specifically burning woody biomass for electric generation like here in New Hampshire? And I want to thank this person for the question.
That is an excellent question once again. You are correct. New Hampshire does have a tradition of burning under the auspices of renewable energy, wood biomass to produce electricity. But I'm going to throw a caveat out there, because one of the problems that I see right now, and I see it everywhere, we talked about the different regions of the state. One thing that I could say, one of the common themes of businesses across the state when they raise concerns for me, it's not the first concern, but it's the second concern. I'm sure we'll get to the first concern later. Their second concern across the board seems to be the lack of the ability to have cheap and reliable energy. It's a huge economic issue for our state and for our region. Unfortunately, New Hampshire right now is suffering under some of the highest electric rates in the country right now.
So what's a Jim Lawrence solution to that?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of those decisions that led to us being there were made at the state level. I'll definitely do what I can if I'm elected to Congress to help support that process. But what I was getting to is the fact that we talk about renewable energy. We need to protect our environment, no doubt. We need to fight and continue to fight for energy independence. But at what cost? We need to make sure that we're also making prudent decisions. Unfortunately, our state has entered into some long-term contracts under some of these programs that has directly negatively impacted the ratepayers. That is the direct cause of some of the increases of our electric rates. We need to look at long-term solutions that not only protect our environment, but also protect our ability to have a strong economy going into the future. So my plan, as I look forward, and this would be the litmus test for any plan like this, I would look for to make sure that not only that we're protecting the environment, but we're not going to be doing something that's negatively going to impact the ratepayers or negatively impact our ability to provide cheap and reliable energy.
There are those who say that New Hampshire has put too many eggs in the natural gas basket. And again, in your part of the state, there have been a lot of fights about pipelines. Real quick, Mr. Lawrence, what do you think? Too much reliance on natural gas here in the Granite State?
Well, a smart investor would always tell you that diversity is probably your best insurance against future crisis. So I'm not going to say that we have too much or too little right now, but I would be a proponent of having a diversified plan to provide energy for the state.
All right. Coming up, we will turn to immigration policy and gun laws, plus a lot more questions from our audience. Our Conversations with the Candidate series continues here on NHPR. Welcome back to our Conversations with the Candidate series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy along with Josh Rogers. Our guest is 2nd District Congressional candidate Jim Lawrence. He's the Republican nominee challenging incumbent Democrat Ann McLean Custer. We're also taking questions from our audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network, as well as those submitted in advance on social media. And Josh, let's start off with a question from you.
Okay, I'd like to ask about immigration, Mr. Lawrence. You've said, quote, whether you believe in mass deportation or not, if you do not secure the border, We cannot prevent them from coming back. So my question is, do you believe in mass deportation?
Well, I think probably the quote that you pulled from, I was talking something along the lines of what my first priority would be, and that hasn't changed. What my philosophy is that it doesn't make sense to talk about any kind of immigration reform or talk about whether we have legitimate immigration laws in this country now until we have a secured border. Because until you have a secured border, any laws that you talk about, any immigration reforms that you come up with, they're de facto unenforceable because of a porous border. And there's a secondary reason why I think that the border security is a top priority is a security reason. We're dealing with a large drug crisis in this state and the country right now. We've identified our porous border as a potential source of a lot of illegal narcotics coming into our country and further eroding our ability to fight this drug crisis, not to mention the fact that we still are very much looking or engaged in trying to protect American citizens from world terrorism, acts of terror against our citizens. So I do believe that our top priority should be, in terms of immigration right now, to secure our border. Now, does that mean I say I want to build a wall across a 2,000-plus-mile level of terrain in the southern border? No, I'm not an advocate of that because I don't think it's economically feasible to do that in a short period of time. However, I do believe that we could secure that border by a combination of things, building a wall or fence where practical, augmenting that with electronic countermeasures, and once again augmenting those two provisions with manpower. This is something that we can do. It's the most efficient way to secure that border, and I would be an advocate to secure our borders immediately, primarily for security purposes, but the added benefit of securing that border would be to make sure that we actually have a secure border. And once you have a secure border, now you can have a realistic dialogue about what you want to do about immigration reform and come up with immigration laws and policies that make sense that are actually enforceable.
Well, so do you believe that people here illegally, assuming the border could be secured, should be sent back to their country of origin?
You know, that's an interesting question because we are theoretically a land of laws, and I still do believe that that is the case. We are a country of laws. I don't think it does us any service to say that we're going to have laws on the books and not enforce them. That being said, I'm sure there's extenuating circumstances to any example that you find in life. So my plan, once again, is just to secure that border first. And then once we've secured that border, now we could start to have a realistic dialogue about what we can actually realistically achieve in terms of immigration policy, immigration reform, and do something that's going to accomplish our near-term goals, which in my estimation are keeping ourselves safe and making sure that we don't negatively impact our economy.
So one new provision in the state GOP platform defines trespass to include illegal presence in New Hampshire. You know, as you may recall, some years back that approach was taken in a couple communities, including your hometown of Hudson and New Ipswich as well. A judge ruled that unconstitutional. That opinion was shared by then Attorney General Kelly Ayotte. What do you think about that provision in the platform? Do you think that's something that ought to be pursued?
You know, it's kind of interesting. You can always look at candidates in terms of their party platforms and say, okay, well, this person is defined by this platform. You know, I don't really view candidates or my candidacy in terms of the Republican platform. I mean, there are some things I agree with, there's some things I disagree with. In this particular case, I would have to say that my platform on immigration that I just stated to you doesn't necessarily line up directly with that. So I would say my platform is the platform that I believe is the right way to move forward with immigration reform. And I will support more likely than not the majority of the Republican platform, but not all of it.
Okay. We received an email from Ron who had a question on immigration. And this is Ron. How would you propose addressing the presence of some 10 million undocumented individuals while balancing issues such as family unity, employer needs, and, of course, security? Thanks for the email, Ron. What do you have to say to Ron, Mr. Lawrence?
I'd have to say to Ron that he's got a very good question. It's an emerging issue that nobody has really been able to deal with to date. I do think that we do need to deal with it on short order. But once again, I think that the first issue is to secure our border first, and then we could start talking about how we can come up with a solution for that. It's going to be a tough situation. It didn't emerge overnight. It's not going to be solved tomorrow.
Mr. Lawrence, I want to ask you about police relations with minority communities, especially interesting given that you were the first African-American major party nominee running for Congress here in New Hampshire. And as I understand, your father was a police officer in New York for many years. So this is an especially relevant question for you. You have in part blamed President Obama for some of the tension. First of all, let's hear what you said.
I think what the president has done, unfortunately, is he's continued to fan the flames of racial hatred instead of highlighting the things that unite us. He's made inflammatory statements that have emboldened Black Lives Matters. And we just talked, both of the candidates here on the stage talked about the importance of community policing to solve some of these issues. It's very difficult to enact effective community policing when the community and the police department are at odds with each other.
What sorts of statements has the president said that you feel have, as you said, inflamed tensions?
Well, I mean, I'll go with the most recent example that I can think of, probably close to that statement that I made. Right after the horrific acts in Dallas, which resulted in the shooting of several police officers, unfortunately, in my estimation, there were statements that were made that supported the Black Lives Matters movement. I think Black Lives Matter is unfortunately a more divisive group than it needs to be. I mean, in my estimation, I'd prefer if the president had used language more along the lines that all lives matters. And I think that this is an important distinction because at the same time that the president was touting Black Lives Matters for the good work that they've done, is that's his quote, not mine, we had it, public figures like Snoop Dogg, of all people, standing side by side with the police chief in Los Angeles saying that, hey, as community, we need to come together. We need to work together. Because the only way that we're going to solve this issue is by opening the dialogue between all the communities, all the police organizations, in order to start to try and heal the wounds of the past and move forward and fix this problem. In my estimation, Washington, D.C.'s number one role in this particular issue should have been to try and bring Americans of all walks of life together, so that we can move forward together as Americans to try and address these issues. If we're constantly arguing with each other, glorifying the things that divide us, continuing to argue about what our issues are and not listening, not talking to each other, not bringing police communities together with their police departments, we're never going to solve this problem. So, you know, it's just kind of a difficult situation for me to talk about because, as you said earlier, my father was a police officer. He was actually one of the pioneers of implementing community policing in the United States, which I think is a very, very useful tool. It's something that's vital for us to be able to have effective policing in the future. I'm not seeing the rhetoric coming out of the leadership in Washington supporting those aims, glorifying the fact that we have many, many more things that unite us than divide us. I don't hear the rhetoric coming out of Washington, D.C., highlighting the fact that the overwhelming majority of law enforcement officers perform their jobs every day very well to keep us safe. And these types of things need to be heard. These types of things need to come out of the leadership in Washington, D.C., and unfortunately, that hasn't happened to date.
What responsibility do you think, Mr. Lawrence, that police have in all this? We've all seen the videos of unarmed Black men being shot to death.
Well, I think everybody has responsibility in this. And this is, you know, I started off by saying the overwhelming majority of police officers do their job very well every day. That's a fact. Does that mean that there aren't any problems out there? No. But the solution to fixing those problems is by bringing the communities together. Violence is rarely a good answer to try and address an issue even as horrific as the one or two cases where you may have something that happens where, you know, an officer may have crossed a certain line. But the critical issue here is that we need to bring the communities together. Without having that dialogue, we have no chance of solving this problem.
Some African Americans complain about the so-called crime of driving while black, just being randomly pulled over.
I think I'm guilty of that every day.
Have you ever been pulled over for driving while black?
You know what? I'll be honest with you. I've never asked an officer that pulled me over whether he pulled me over because I was black. So I guess you'll have to ask the police officer that. No, that's not – I mean, I'm joking. I'm saying I'm guilty of that every day because I'm a black man who drives a car. I don't get pulled over every day. I drive around in my community every day. I didn't drive here, unfortunately, but I could, you know, I could tell you, you know, there's many cases where I've had interactions with law enforcement, and not once can I tell you that they, I feel that they pulled me over solely because of my race.
How uncomfortable is this for you, Mr. Lawrence, as a topic, given your father's background, given your own background? I bet you get asked about this a lot.
I wouldn't say I get asked about it as much as I get asked about the presidential election this cycle, but I do get asked about it fairly frequently, and I wouldn't say that it's more uncomfortable for me than any other American. I think it's an uncomfortable topic in general right now, and I think it's probably because a lot of Americans feel like we're very divided right now, and that's why I keep saying it's so vitally important that all of our leadership in the country – particularly, and I'm going to say it right now, I think the president was in a unique position to be able to bring all communities together, being the first African-American elected president of the United States. And I think this is one area that he may look back later on in his life and say that, hey, I missed the mark on that, because this was a huge opportunity to bring communities together. And you see across the country right now they are not.
Let's take another question from our audience. And by the way, I want to let everyone know we can take your emails at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook. Post your question there. We're talking with Jim Lawrence. He's the Republican nominee for the 2nd Congressional District in New Hampshire. We have an audience with us here at Studio D at NHPR. And here's another question from our audience. Go ahead, sir, and thank you for coming out.
Yes, Fred from Goffstown. Do you support expanding and not cutting Social Security's modest earned benefits?
A question about Social Security. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that question. You know, it's interesting because Social Security, in my estimation, is one of the largest challenges we have facing us right now, currently as a country. And it's one of the largest issues also that a lot of people aren't willing to discuss. That's why early on in this candidacy, very early on before the primary, I was one of the first candidates to actually come forward with a public plan to address our looming Social Security crisis. And the reason why I took it so seriously, I mean, I actually have some selfish reasons. I have 8 children. It's not just for people who are currently on Social Security. We have to get this right so that future generations of Americans will be able to get the benefits that we're all contributing to. And my plan to save Social Security is just this. The first priority, what we need to do is fence off the payroll taxes that we collect to fund Social Security. Unfortunately, Congress in the past has dipped into this fund and spent it for other reasons. That was a contributing factor to why we have the crisis looming now. We have to fix that. And the reason why we need to fix it is because even if we make it solvent, if we don't do that, then we run the risk of Congress going in and spending that money once again and creating the crisis all over again.
Is that the Social Security lockbox that Al Gore talked about so many years ago?
I wouldn't call it a lockbox, but, you know, there's plenty of precedent for that. I mean, right here in our state of New Hampshire, we do something similar with the gas tax to make sure that that money is reserved for the highway fund. I mean, this is even worse than that. I mean, we're collecting taxes. We're taking payroll taxes from people, from Americans, hardworking Americans, for the purpose of funding Social Security. That money should be dedicated to that fund.
I'm glad you asked the question, because just a couple quick follow-ups, Mr. Lawrence. There are fixes that are often mentioned. I'm sure you're aware of them. One is raise the Social Security income cap. Right now, any income above about $120,000 is not taxed. So this is said to favor the wealthy, because after $120,000, all that goes away, tax-free income above that. Is this also a better way to fund the system, make it more solvent and more fair?
Well, I'm glad you brought up that point, because what I was going to get into is once you've actually, you know, protected the funds that you're collecting for Social Security, it's not going to fix the solvency issue. So now begins the hard work of sharpening your pencil and figuring out what type of tough choices you need to make to stave off the fiscal cliff that Social Security is going to go over in the future. And I do think that raising the cap on payroll taxes is one of the potential solutions that we should be considering. But I don't think that's enough. I think you need to leave all options on the table. I'm going to be very specific. I think that what you need to do is you need to grandfather anyone who's currently in the system currently that's receiving benefits. So you're not going to change what they're receiving for Social Security. But now you need to look at Social Security benefits for future, for people who will actually join the system in the future. And you need to make tough choices, and you need to make it solvent. And unfortunately, that's going to have to there's going to be some painful decisions there. You are going to have to look on raising the cap on payroll taxes. You may have to look at raising the age of eligibility. You may have to look at other eligibility requirements. But the one thing that I can guarantee you is that if we do this now, it's going to be a lot less painful and a lot easier to accomplish it than if we wait 10 years later when we're actually right at the edge of it collapsing. If you wait, it's going to be more painful, more difficult to get the job done. So it's very important that we start looking at this seriously now and actually fix it once and for all.
Josh, back to you.
All right, let's turn to guns. That's been a big issue this campaign season. Why don't we listen to a little tape? Here's how you described your position during the WMUR primary debate.
I support the Second Amendment in every other part of the Constitution. I do not believe that we should be picking and choosing parts of the Constitution to follow. We do have background checks on the books currently. We need to enforce the laws that are on the books.
All right. So that was you during the primary debate on WMUR. In terms of enforcing laws currently on the books, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has said that it doesn't have enough people to effectively enforce current law, and that Congress has rejected requests that would allow them to add more agents. Would you vote to give the ATF more funding in furtherance of enforcing current law?
You know, before I answered that, I'm a details guy. I mean, I spent a lot of time advising the federal government already on large budgetary items. I'd want to see the detailed data behind that to back that up before I give you an answer on that. But what I can tell you is that I do believe that there are certain areas that we can highlight from recent occurrences, like the Orlando shooting, for example, which is one of the instances that really, you know, kicked up the heat on this particular issue.
And Mr. Lawrence, pardon me for interrupting. We will pick up more on this gun issue after a very short break, okay?
Okay,
I know there's a lot more
I'll
to talk about here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Our Conversations with the Candidates series continues in just a moment. Welcome back to our Conversations with the Candidates series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest is Jim Lawrence. He's the Republican nominee for the 2nd Congressional District. We're taking questions from our live audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network, as well as those submitted in advance on social media. And you can send us an email right now if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Mr. Lawrence, just before the break, you were responding to a question from Josh Rogers about whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has enough money to enforce the laws already on the books, which is what you said you think should be the first priority of our approach toward guns. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, as I was saying before, you know, I'd have to look and research, you know, the details in terms of see the data that they were producing for the ATF to actually see what their funding level is now and what the adequate level of funding should be. But I was going back to the Orlando shooting incident, which was a recent occurrence, a tragic occurrence that happened here that definitely kicked up the heat on the debate on keeping us safe from gun violence. And one thing that I really draw from this, I look at my dad's law enforcement experience, I look at my own personal experience, and the one thing that really jumps out at me in that particular incident, here's an individual who we tagged him. The FBI actually interviewed him twice. They identified him as somebody who had ties to terrorists internationally, and we missed the boat. I view the area that we could actually improve to help keep us safe, probably to prevent this incident and other incidents like it, is to improve our resources for law enforcement intelligence gathering. Because we should have been able to identify him and actually draw the connection. They interviewed him twice. They knew he had terrorist connections. We should have been watching him. We could have prevented this from happening. And I think that when you look at that, you have to be smart about looking at the mistakes that you've made in the past. Try and learn from those mistakes and close those gaps. There's a clear area there where we could have used the existing laws on the books to prevent this tragedy from happening. So that's what I think our focus needs to be, is on where we failed the American people in this particular case, unfortunately, to keep them safe. We understand what happened. I think we could close those loops by giving the FBI and other law enforcement the resources they need to help enforce these laws, and we'd be much safer as a result of that.
I mean, do you think universal background checks on all gun purchases would step on the Second Amendment too much in your estimation?
Well, we almost have universal background check for firearms in this country. I mean, I know that when I've purchased firearms, that they've done background checks on me. And I don't think anyone who's pro-Second Amendment or not would argue against that. I mean, everybody wants to keep Americans safe. But we also need to remember that we're trying to protect our civil liberties. And I started off that debate answer by saying I support every element of the Constitution. I really do, because let's face facts. The day that we're willing to give up our civil liberties, the day we're willing to forfeit our constitutional rights, that's the day that the people who want to do us harm, the terrorists, have already won. It's not worth it for us to give up who we are as Americans just to keep ourselves safe.
But so just to be clear, your position on universal background checks, private sales, you'd be open to contemplating that?
I would be open to do anything that would keep Americans safe, but I also said that I think the existing laws on the books are adequate. So I think that pretty much answers that question.
I want to ask you, Mr. Lawrence, a question about health care. You have said in terms of the Affordable Care Act you'd like to get rid of the bad parts and keep the good parts. What are the bad parts, in your opinion, and does that statement imply that there are good parts as well?
Well, I think what the statement implies is that whether I agreed with the passage of the law in the beginning or not is irrelevant. The law has been on the books for several years, and there are American citizens that are now relying on this this law for their health care benefits. So, you know, I don't believe that Congress should be in the job of taking people's health care away. I think it was a bad law. Matter of fact, I know it was a bad law because 2 years ago I said it was going to drive costs up and it was going to limit our options. And lo and behold, here we are now, and we've seen the evidence. It drives up our cost of health care and it limits our options. You asked for specifics. One of the specifics hasn't been allowed to be implemented because they didn't want to create even more damage to the system that's already been done, is the Cadillac tax. That Cadillac tax is still a looming specter that's supposed to be implemented, which is part of the Affordable Care Act. If that's ever implemented, the damage that it would do to our health care system as well as our economy would be disastrous. We could never allow that to happen.
Cadillac tax is the tax that's
on premium insurance plans, or what they determine to be premium insurance plans.
So that's a bad part under
that's
your list of sort of good parts and bad parts.
That's absolutely definitely a bad part.
What's a good part?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily a good part that I'm highlighting. What I'm acknowledging is that people are using this law now to have health care. Whether I agreed with it before or not, it's there. So I have to be realistic in my approach to make sure that we're not damaging the American people's ability to get the health care that they deserve. So if they're on that health care, We need to manage that system, improve it so that we can lessen some of the blows of the damage that the Affordable Care Act did to our health care system and move forward. It's not that different from what I see with the VA. I mean, the VA system is not a perfect system. Me being a veteran myself, I'm very sensitive to the fact that a lot of veterans can't get the health care that they deserve. The problem is what do you do with it? You can't scrap the entire system because there are veterans like my father. My father received cancer treatment from the VA. I don't want to take health benefits from the VA.
So you're wholesale. Not a repeal and replace Republican?
Not at this point in time. The law's been in place for too long. You just can't. There are unintended consequences of passing broad sweeping legislation without doing your homework, and that would be another case of that.
Let's take another question from our audience. And good morning. Thank you for coming out. And go ahead and give us your name and ask your question, please.
Hi, my name is Christina. I'm a member of the Concord Young Professionals Network. Now that we're talking about veterans, what is your plan to help get veterans back to work in the Granite State?
Thank you very much, Christina, for the question. And I have heard from veterans that, you know, they come back from war and it is sometimes hard to find employment, businesses that understand, you know, what your skill set is. Go ahead, Mr. Lawrence.
You know, that's definitely a subject that's near and dear to my heart. Not only am I a veteran, but a funny thing that not a lot of people know is that my father was a police officer. But one of the reasons of why he became a police officer is because he actually took the police exam before he went to Vietnam. And it's actually a good thing that he did because guess what? When he came back from war, he couldn't find a job. And the police department actually called him back up after several months, and he was able to get a job and provide for his family, and we're very thankful for that. But that's always been an issue historically in this country, and it's something that, you know, we really do owe our veterans, you know, to do them justice. We owe them better. But I think the best way to help veterans and all Americans in terms of getting gainful employment is to help our economy go forward. Right now, our economy is sluggish. We've had 8 years where the highest GDP growth rate has been 3%. That's one of the worst in the history of this country. And I believe that that is the direct result of what our federal government has done and failed to do. The overregulation of businesses, the antiquated overtaxation of businesses, they've put obstacles in the way of industry to be able to create new jobs in our economy. And that impacts everyone. And unfortunately, veterans who come back from war, they've been out of the job market. They're kind of, you know, subject to the whim of our economy. So the best thing that we can do is have a strong economy so there are more jobs for everyone. And, you know, I know my company, and I know there's a lot of other companies out there that they do extend themselves to veterans networks to try and hire veterans. So that's another type of program that I would highly encourage in the future.
Christina, thank you for the question. And Josh Rogers, back to you.
All right, we'll turn from veterans to foreign affairs and military policy. You've said, quote, we need to stand up to our enemies and take the fight to them. What does that mean, take the fight to them?
Boy, that's a pretty harsh quote there. I don't remember saying that one.
Well.
You know, but I do agree that our policy is not what it should be. Our foreign policy, I believe, is the worst that we've had in decades. Our allies don't feel like they can count on us. Our enemies certainly do not fear us. I mean, we see evidence of this all over the world right now. Russia, for example, right now, they're taking some very aggressive steps against allies of the United States. They certainly do not feel like they need to control themselves right now based on our foreign policy. We have rebels in Yemen firing on our naval ships in the open seas. The world is becoming rapidly a very dangerous place, and I think, unfortunately, our lack of having good foreign policy for the past decade or so has contributed significantly to that. So when I make statements about us having the worst foreign policy in decades, what I'm talking about is making sure that when we implement foreign policy, particularly when we send messages to the world, they should understand that when the United States says something, they mean it. And when we do something or when we say we're going to do something, we're going to follow through. I think that's going to make everyone around the world safer, including us. And I think, unfortunately, the current administration This is a weak point, and we need to do something to reverse the damage that's been done.
Well, you bring up Russia, and in the context of Syria, you've said that essentially you'd be hesitant to sacrifice brave men and women in the armed forces for police actions around the world. How do you view Syria? Do you view it as a police action?
Well, I don't view it as a police action because I'm going to tell you when I made that statement, I was actually criticizing a very specific plan. The plan was to send in United States Marines to actually fight and control territory within Syria to create a safe zone that we would protect as the United States so that Syrian refugees could actually stay over in Syria. That is clearly a police action, and I would never support an action like that because I don't believe that that is the proper utilization for the United States Armed Forces. That being said, I wouldn't support what I consider to be police actions anywhere. I think that using our military is an action of last resort. We should only use the United States military as a last resort, and I think it should only be used to directly defend Americans or our national interest. And fighting to create a safe zone in Syria for Syrian refugees, I do not believe rises to that test.
So short of the U.S. being directly under threat or what would be
our national interest? So, for example, I do believe that fighting ISIS is a legitimate use of our U.S. armed forces because we've seen time and time again that ISIS threatens our national interests. They threaten us by sponsoring terrorism on our home soil. We owe it to the American people to keep them safe, and that's a legitimate utilization of our armed forces.
All right. Turn from one fraught topic to another, that of abortion. On abortion, on your website, you say you believe that life begins at conception and that you are, quote, strongly pro-life. Does that mean that you believe abortion should be illegal?
You know, I've always been a pro-life candidate. I have three solid terms as a New Hampshire state legislator that backs that up. You notice that when I go through the campaign trail, you're actually the first person who's asked me this question. And I think the reason why that is the case is because if you look, my policies or my plans on all my literature and in all the speeches that I've made are actually in priority order and what I believe are the top priorities to the voters of this state. And if you look, the voters are talking about things like the $19.5 trillion national debt. They're talking about our economy. They're talking about our failed foreign policy, keeping us safe from ISIS, the drug crisis. They're talking about solving Social Security and this looming crisis. They're talking about overregulation and taxation of businesses, the flight of businesses out of this country. Those are the issues that my candidacy is focused on, and that's what I'm going to continue to do. That happens to subscribe to a personal belief system that I have, but let's face facts. We've been arguing about this issue back and forth for several decades, and we use it as good political fodder for discussion, but nothing ever changes. We understand what the law of the land is, so we're going to move forward from there.
Okay, well, one reason I ask is that it's been, I think, 25 years at least since the district in which you're running, the 2nd CD, sent somebody to Congress who is against abortion, and that includes people from both parties. So I guess one reason I'm asking is, do you see that? Do you see your stance as a political hurdle at a minimum?
No, I don't, because I don't think that that's the priority that the voters are looking at right now, and neither have I expressed that that's my priority. I'm squarely focused on what I think we need to do to move our country forward. And although that's, you know, it's a personal belief system, it's very personal, people have different opinions on that issue, I don't think that Congress is going to enact legislation that deals with that. And that's not what my focus is. So, no, I don't think that's a big issue.
But just to be clear, your opposition to abortion contains no exceptions or abortion in some circumstances?
You know, it's an interesting topic to discuss because, you know, like I said, I can't stress this enough. We've discussed this issue back and forth, like you said, for three decades. I mean, the last time that somebody held this seat that was considered to be pro-life, we've actually discussed it in this country for longer than that. The debate has gone all the way back to the early 70s. And the realistic issue here is that we talk about it during every election cycle, but it's not really a change factor. Nothing has changed.
I'm asking is, what is your position? I mean, you can choose to answer that however you like, but you know, I'm asking a direct question.
Look, it's not a priority to the voters of this state currently. It's not one of my top priorities right now. That's just the way I look at it.
All right. We're running out of time, so I'll ask you one big last question, which is we'll put it under the rubric of why do you want to do this? You know, you're running for Congress.
No, I'm not mentally ill.
The latest Gallup poll shows congressional approval at 20%, which is actually better than it has been recently. And, you know, a lot of voters I talk to seem to be, you know, pretty discouraged about, you know, congressional dysfunction. You know, why shouldn't they be?
I'm not going to say they shouldn't be, and that's part and parcel a large reason why I'm running. You know, I'm one of those citizens that are looking at Congress and saying they're not doing their job. You listen to every speech I've made across the state. I've said Washington is broken. I can't look my 8 children in the eye knowing that I stood by and did nothing while Washington continued to spend their future prosperity away. We've talked about all the issues that are facing us. Congress has not done their job effectively to solve them, and I want to be the guy that goes down to Washington. I'm asking for people to vote for me on November 8th so that if they stand with me, I promise I'll stand up for them in Washington, D.C., and support the voters of this great state.
Well, and that wraps it up for our conversation with 2nd Congressional District GOP nominee Jim Lawrence. Again, we've extended an invitation to Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer to join us at a future date. Thanks to everybody for being here, and especially thank you, Mr. Lawrence, for turning out today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.